So it's been a little cooler the last couple of days, but the snow is still melting really fast, Julie, isn't it?
It sure is. How was your weekend, Phil?
It was filled with a lot of outdoor stuff. Looking around, there's a lot of people who are getting outside, and the snow line, again, is retreating up to about the levels we usually see in June. In fact, looking at Baldy, and the old adage locally is you wait till the snow's off Baldy to put your tomatoes out, and I usually anticipate that the middle of June, but looking at that, it might be in the next week or so.
I put some tomatoes in yesterday, and I didn't know that adage, so I hope I'm okay.
Well, this year you're okay, but do watch the snow line, and despite the colder temperatures the last couple of days and what looks like a light dusting of snow on Schweitzer, the snow line's up above treeline. A lot of people are out hiking. A lot of people are out paddling, kayaking on the lakes, and whitewater kayaking on the Lightning Creek I saw, and a lot of people going down the Pack River. And this time of year, that can be a dangerous mix with the warm spring days and yet still snow melt cold water. People who are playing around, if they're not watching it, they subject themselves to hypothermia really quickly. And although that may not be one of the immediate threats the water keepers is looking after as a recreational user.
Nothing that we want to see, though. Yeah,
one of my connections to the lake.
That's right. And of course, it was Mother's Day over the weekend. And interestingly, today in 1908 was the first Mother's Day celebrated in West Virginia. So happy Mother's Day yesterday to all those moms out there.
So Shannon, what did your kids do for you?
Well, they played a lot of soccer that I got to watch.
We had
a soccer tournament all weekend. Yeah. But one of my kiddos was on the championship team, so that was pretty awesome. Great Mother's Day present.
That's a wonderful present.
It was super fun.
That's pretty neat.
Well, as we go into the interview, I'd like to read first a quote for you from William Wordsworth, one of my favorite poets. He wrote, "A lake carries you into the recess of feeling, otherwise impenetrable."
That's a great quote.
Yeah. And he grew up in the Lakes District of England, in the northern part, where there's indeed a lot of mountains and a lot of water, just like here. And I think that maybe is what the Lake Pend Oreille Waterkeepers is all about.
Yeah, I think that really does speak to our mission. It does.
Do you want to delve a little bit more broadly into, say, the first-time listener who might not have heard of the Waterkeepers before?
Sure.
What the Waterkeepers' vision is, what the work is that you do.
Right, yeah. So we have a very straightforward mission, and that's to protect the water quality of the Clark Fork Pend Oreille watershed so that we keep this water swimmable, fishable, and drinkable for future generations. We do that in a lot of different ways, which I'm sure we'll get into further along in the interview, but that's our overarching mission. And we've been in existence in Sandpoint since 2009.
So how did you get started?
Well, there was a grassroots community effort, I guess you would say, organized around pesticide use in Lake Pend Oreille. So in 2006, there was a ramped up effort on behalf of the state to get rid of invasive Eurasian water milfoil using chemicals. And many people in the community were unhappy with that strategy, and they started organizing around it. And so those organized activities drew the attention of a funder who asked the organization if they'd be interested in organizing into a waterkeeper organization under the umbrella of the Waterkeeper Alliance, which is a global organization. And so this grassroots efforts translated itself into a waterkeeper group.
Wonderful. So originally, the main focus was around Eurasian milfoil and other aquatic invasive species, but the work has broadened since then.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about what the scope of the work is the waterkeepers doing these days.
Right. We really were a singular issue focused organization early on, but really since I joined the organization in 2011, we've really diversified our work around the watershed. And so we still do focus on pesticide use in the watershed, but some of our other priority issues include fossil fuel by rail transport, which is the transport of coal and crude oil by rail around and over Lake Pend Oreille. We also focus on wastewater-related issues. We have three municipal discharging facilities in our watershed that we pay attention to. We've recently ramped up our efforts on stormwater, and we've created several distinct programs around water quality monitoring. So we have a seasonal June through October lake and river-wide water quality monitoring program that's citizen science-based, and we kicked off a new initiative this spring to study the composition of stormwater, also using citizen scientists. And then we also bring several different programs to the youth in our community. We have a day camp in the summer called Watershed Discovery Camp, and we also bring a really fun interactive lake model into the classrooms in the Lake Pendere School District to talk about lake ecology.
We'll hear more about that later. I've got more questions for you about those programs, but I'd like to back up one step and just ask you more about Waterkeeper itself and how it is connected with the other associations, such as the Hudson River Riverkeeper, the connection with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Mm-hmm. How many Waterkeeper or Riverkeepers are there out there?
I believe we're approaching 300 globally. Ooh. And most of them are focused in the United States, but we've had quite the proliferation in Asia as well, China, Bangladesh. So there really is, it really is a global unified effort. And so we all really focus under the same model, but each watershed has its own challenges. And so our issues could be vastly different than those of, say, people working in the Chesapeake Bay region. But we also do have similarities with other waterkeepers in the Pacific Northwest. For example, our work on fossil fuel by rail. There's several waterkeepers from Montana to Washington or that are working on that issue. But it really, it's the challenges that your watershed faces is what drives what you do in each organization.
So locally, regionally, if you will, locally, I know there's waterkeeper organizations in Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, I believe.
Mm-hmm. There's three in Idaho, two mm-hmm. in North Idaho. So Coeur d'Alene Lakekeeper, which is basically a subset of Kootenai Environmental Alliance, which has been around for a very long time. And then a Snake River Keeper in southern Idaho. And then I guess in our region, we also have the Spokane River Keeper. And then further west, there's the Puget Sound Keeper. And then probably the biggest density of waterkeeper organizations on the West Coast or throughout California.
So do you interact much with them? Do you coordinate your activities or the scale of things you're doing?
To the extent that it makes sense for all of us. Sure. You know, we're all independent organizations.
So it's a loose organization.
Yeah, yeah. So if we do have an issue in common, for example, the fossil fuel by rail, we organize our activities around that to increase the impact of our efforts collectively. And then once a year, we all get together at a waterkeeper conference coming up the first week of June. This year, it's going to be in North Carolina. And that's a really great opportunity for me to learn as an executive director, you know, new skills to run the organization, but also strategies around the issues that we work on.
So I'm glad you mentioned that because I'm interested. I think the folks who are listening are interested in personal connections. What draws you to this field of work? What drew you to Sandpoint and the waterkeepers?
Well, I just love the water. I mean, I grew up on the East Coast, and I've always been around the ocean. I hadn't really spent a lot of time around freshwater bodies. And so my whole life, up until the point where I came to Sandpoint, all of my work was focused on our oceans. I got my bachelor's degree in marine biology. I got a PhD in marine science. And I moved to Sandpoint from San Diego, where I was studying marine viruses and bacteria. So quite the departure. But I did make it up to Sandpoint. I'd been visiting Sandpoint before relocating for several years. My ex-husband's family lives up here. And so we made the move when the kids were quite young. And I had just really appreciated just the beauty of the lake for as long as I had been visiting and really had this unique opportunity to transition careers into advocacy work, which is something that had really intrigued me. I loved my work as a research scientist, and I felt like we were producing really important information, but I never felt that it was being put into practice to protect the environment, which was a little frustrating for me. And so this opportunity came along, and I said, sure, I'm going to give it a shot. So it's been great.
So how much of your days are filled with marine biology or lake biology, and how much with the administrative side of running an organization?
Good question. So it's a little bit different every day, which is one of the things I enjoy most about my job is no 2 days are alike. And some days, usually towards the summer months, it's more focused on the science because mm-hmm. we have our active monitoring programs going on at that point. But really, every day is full of different tasks from, I don't know, cleaning the bathroom to organizing our monitoring program or digging into another issue that we're working on, working with the EPA, other regulatory agencies. So it really varies on a daily basis.
Sure.
It sounds like you've been able to combine the science with advocacy, a nice job for you.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you why the average person would feel waterkeeper's work is important. Why would we be interested in that?
Well, I think everybody can appreciate, you know, what an amazing resource Lake Ponderay is and all the waters in our watershed. And it's not really anything you can argue about that it's incredible. And I think everybody on some level really wants it to be protected. We might have differences in how we feel that should be approached, and we definitely have a certain way of doing that. But I don't really think you can argue that keeping Lake Ponderay clean and healthy is a bad thing.
No, I think anyone who has either visited or lives in the area has to feel a connection to the surroundings, including and probably foremost the lake that we live on.
Right.
So if you're just tuning in this morning, this is The Morning Show with Julie and Phil at 88.5 KRFY in Ponderay. And this morning we're talking with Shannon Williamson, the Executive Director of the Lake Ponderay Waterkeepers. Tell us a little more about the Waterkeepers, some of the specific programs. You mentioned in passing some of the things coming up and some of the work that's being done around specific threats and then more generalized education. But let's roll through some of those.
Okay. So some of our programs include our water quality monitoring program. We're going into our fifth year, which is you know, probably our biggest program and the one we're most proud of, I guess I would say. It was started back in 2012 with 11 stations and a bunch of dedicated volunteers that agreed to help us go out to these different locations across the lake and river and gather basic water quality data that would help us build a baseline data set that we could compare future observations to. And so now we're into our fifth year. We've expanded it to 15 locations. We gather almost 1,000 data points a season from June to October.
And what are you finding? Is water quality staying the same? What's happening?
Well, pretty much across the lake, I'd say water quality, you know, we're really in a great fortunate situation up here. You know, we could be on a very polluted water body fighting to restore it, but we're trying to protect it from getting that way in the first place. And water quality overall is pretty good. There are certain locations that we monitor where that's not the case. And so we watch those very closely to see how they're either improving or declining year by year and trying to find out what's contributing to the status of water quality in those locations.
So how does that data get used? Do you work with agencies or others to look at the data and then take action on it?
Right. Well, we do share it widely. It's first and foremost available on our website for the public to see. We graph it up, and you can interact with the data. And if you're living or visiting a certain area of the lake, you can click on a point on our map and see what the water quality is like. But perhaps more importantly, we developed a quality assurance project plan around it, which holds us to a very high standard of quality in how we collect the data and how we evaluate the data so that we can share it with our state regulatory agency. And the EPA at the federal level has used it as well.
So you mentioned earlier citizen science, and this would be an example of the kind of citizen science that the waterkeepers are working on.
Yes. Yeah. We rely really heavily on our very dedicated volunteers to collect this. There's no way. We have a staff of two. There's no way we could collect this information without volunteers.
And Shannon, what is the website people can go to find that
info?
Well,
the shortened version is www.lpow.org.
So back to the volunteers. Of the original 11, how many of those are still involved? Is this consistent over time, similar or
We have had several that have been there from the beginning. Some folks like to give others an opportunity because we only do have, you know, 15 locations. We have a couple of volunteers that sample multiple locations for us, which is great. And every year we have new interests. So we're going to be doing our trainings coming up here in the next few weeks. And there's a lot of new faces. So that's really exciting for us to see because people are hearing about the program and they're interested in it.
And of course, simply the value of training folks. Then they go out into the community more knowledgeable.
Absolutely. Yeah. And our trainings are very thorough. And I'd say overall, our volunteers do an incredible job at collecting this information for us.
I think so.
And you have some other projects coming up that are also going to be monitoring stormwater?
Right. We initiated a stormwater monitoring program in March. It's a pilot study. We were just sampling for March, April, and May, collecting once a month. And we started this program because there is nobody else that is looking at what's in our stormwater. And we know that nationwide, stormwater is the biggest pollutant to our nation's waterways. And yet we have no idea what's going into ours. And we've taken, or I say we as a city and some actions in the county to mitigate stormwater impacts, but we don't even know what we're mitigating for. And so it's really important for us to know what is going into our stormwater and where's it coming from and what can we do to minimize those impacts.
So when I think of stormwater, I think of, you know, a sewer, a stormwater drain, not a sewer per se, but a mm-hmm. water that's a drainage that's collecting water from the streets and it's funneling it off into the lake,
right.
Probably in the city of Sandpoint. But I'm sure it's not limited to that. Are there other municipalities or examples around the lake?
Oh, absolutely. All over the county. I mean, we're limited in our funding quite a bit right now. We're trying to expand the program for next year, but we only have the funding to monitor two locations, both of them draining to Sand Creek. One of them's in Ponderay, and one of them is in Sandpoint. But then Sand Creek's, you know, drains into the lake, so it has a direct impact.
Yeah, and you mentioned that some municipalities' wastewater goes into the lake. Is that mm-hmm. treated wastewater? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, it's thankfully all treated wastewater. Whether it's treated well is another question, but so there's the Kootenai-Ponderay Sewer District that discharges to a backwater slough called Boyer Slough over by Odin Bay off of Lake Ponderay. And then the city of Sandpoint discharges their treated wastewater to the Ponderay River around Birch and Ellis Street in that vicinity near Memorial Field. And then the city of Dover discharges their treated wastewater downstream in Dover. And then if you go as far down, we also have a monitoring location just off of the Priest River wastewater discharge site. So there's a lot of treated effluent going into our water bodies. And that, depending on the efficacy of the treatment, can have a really big impact on what those waterways look like.
Does it vary from municipality to municipality?
It does. Each one has kind of a different strategy of treatment. And several of them are kind of at the cusp of needing either serious upgrades or contemplating new construction to meet more stringent regulations that are going to be protective of water quality.
So obviously there's a potential threat to the lake's water quality from wastewater discharge.
Absolutely.
But not just from our communities, from everyone living upstream.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Everyone that's on a septic system, mm-hmm. you know, it's really hard to nail down what the impacts to water quality are from leaking septic, because it's mm-hmm. hard to trace back specifically. But we know there's certain areas, you know, up on Pack River and really many locations around the lake where people are on antiquated septic systems mm-hmm. that collectively impact the quality of the lake.
And so the general water quality monitoring that you're doing, does that have the ability to capture what some of the impacts might be from those or other sources mm-hmm. from cities in Montana upstream?
Well, it'd be hard to track what's coming in from the Clark Fork River. We do have a monitoring location in the Delta. And how we look at potential contamination from wastewater is looking at bacterial indicators of pollution. Mm-hmm. And there is a number that the state sets that says if you go above this, then that sets off, you know, the red alarm. And so we use that as a benchmark. And I think maybe once at one location we exceeded that threshold. Interestingly, in our last stormwater data that we just got back over the weekend, I was looking at it and I had to look twice and rub my eyes because the one sample we collected was, 6 times what the red flag limit is, which was incredibly disturbing. And this is just demonstrates the importance of, like, we had no idea. And the month before it was high, but it wasn't that high. And so we'll collect one more sample next week before we run out of money for the program this season, unfortunately. And we'll see if that's something that continues. But when we start to see numbers like that, and if it's consistent, that's where we need to talk to the state and say, hey, we got to do something about this, because it's a health right. impact, can have health impacts.
So let's draw a line here between this work, which clearly helps to understand what the impact of wastewater might be on the lake and what its suitability for other purposes might be, but some municipalities draw water from the lake for drinking.
Absolutely. Yeah. The city of Sandpoint, you know, we have this beautiful upgraded water treatment plant that went in a couple years ago. And it, you know, it has very sophisticated technology for microbial decontamination at the bacterial level. But many of the potential pathogens that are in water from that can originate from untreated wastewater or poorly treated wastewater are viruses, and they're smaller than the filtration cutoff that the city uses. And that water goes to not only the city of Sandpoint, but is distributed to multiple municipalities locally, including Dover and Ponderé. So, you know, it's a potential concern. I wouldn't say it's a critical concern. I mean, that's why we do the work we do, to keep an eye out mm-hmm. on what is going on with these wastewater treatment plants to ensure that people's health isn't put in jeopardy, or our water quality in general. It's not just mm-hmm. about public health. It's also about the health of the ecosystem and other things that are discharged with wastewater, including what we call nutrients like phosphorus, which algae just adores, and all of the plants in the lake and river. It's their favorite food, and they just love it, and they go nuts when they get it. And so too much of that going in is going to cause the problems that nobody likes to swim and boat around.
It would be easy to say we hope that they take the water out upstream of where they put it back in, but really it's a dynamic system with very few open or closed ends.
Right. It's all connected.
Right. It's all connected, which is underscores why it's so important and critical to keep an eye on that water quality and quantity.
Absolutely.
Shannon, you mentioned that you're testing for bacteria. Do you test for other things too? Or
we test for a lot of things. So in our basic, I shouldn't even call it basic, but our seasonal water quality monitoring program, we test for those bacterial indicators of pollution, but also several different types of nutrients, including a couple of types of nitrogen, a couple of types of phosphorus. We look at the total amount of carbon that's going into the water. Lots of different tests that indicate, that can give us clues into what's going on with each particular location. And so each test has a rationale behind it and can tell us certain things.
And so both the water quality monitoring and the storm water monitoring are citizen science projects.
Yes.
If someone's listening and they want to help out, get involved, how can they do that?
Oh, we would love for them to get involved. And they can contact us through the website at www.lpow.org. I don't know if I said com before. I hope I didn't. It's .org. Or they can contact me directly at shannon@lpow.org. Or just come into our office, which is located on First Avenue across the across from the Starbucks complex. They can also give us a call at 597-7188, and we'll just talk with them about what opportunities we have.
Wonderful.
We've heard quite a bit about the citizen scientists. Perhaps you could tell us about Camp Discovery.
Oh, yes. Our Watershed Discovery Camp. We're really excited to bring that to the community again this year. This is our third year. We just received a grant from the Community Assistance League. Thank you very much. If anybody's out there listening, we really appreciate it to help us put that camp on this year. And it's geared towards 8 through 13-year-old kids in the area. And it's really a unique camp, I think, in this community. It's science-based. It's also based in service and stewardship and, most importantly, fun. But it's all about teaching the kids about water quality and the wonders of our lake and river. And so each day, and we have amazing camp counselors that come in to lead this each summer. And each day we have in the morning a water quality themed lesson, which may sound kind of boring, but it's really not. They make it super fun. And then in the afternoon, we have really fun games and arts and crafts and time to swim at City Beach. And it's really just a very, you know, active outdoor educational experience that, for example, the kids get an opportunity to try stand-up paddle boarding and kayaking. On one day, we do a wetland ecology field trip out to Shepherd Lake and get to try out the ropes challenge course at the Eureka Institute. The Eureka Institute is a co-sponsor of this program. So we partner with them on camp. And the challenge course is always a big hit with the campers. But, you know, I have gotten so much positive feedback from the parents and caregivers of the kids that have attended camp in the past. And another unique feature of the camp is that I think is not offered very frequently is we have extended camp hours. So camp officially starts at 9 o'clock and ends at 4, but for working caregivers, they can drop off as early as 8 o'clock and then pick up at 5, which as a single working parent myself, I find very attractive feature and is I don't really find in other camps. So we also offer partial and full scholarships. So we are limited to 20 participants this year. We're about half full right now. The camp's at the last week of July, so the 25th to the 29th. We do still have some scholarships available and spots available. So if you have a curious kid in your life that you want to experience this really cool camp, then I encourage you to, you can go to our website again or give me a call and I can tell you how to register.
So it goes on for a week or five days?
It's a week, yeah, Monday through Friday. Great. Day camp.
How much fun.
It is super fun.
Oh, yeah. Mom, I want to go to the lake to camp again.
Exactly.
Darn it, I'm too old. I would have liked to go to that. You also have an LPOW Lake Ecology model. Tell us about that.
We do. We're getting ready to bring that into the classrooms. We pretty much do that every spring. And ever since I've been with the organization, it's been going on, I believe, even before I got with the organization. But we have this fantastic lake model that's a cross-section of our lake. So if you took a butter knife and cut it in half, you could see the different types of topography. And it's glass on both sides. And we take it into fifth and sixth grade science classrooms across the district. And we give a presentation that's very hands-on that talks about food web dynamics and how a healthy lake is built and maintained. And then what pollution can do to disrupt that healthy ecosystem. And it's hands-on because kids actually build the lake from what we call the smallest to the largest creatures. So they add what we call phytoplankton. So our little floating plants in the water like algae, and then the zooplankton, that little microscopic animals that eat the phytoplankton, and so on and so forth. And then we actually bring our pet goldfish that have been alive forever and have sustained multiple trips throughout the county in Tupperware containers. And the kids get to add the fish at the top. And then we talk about how we can maintain this healthy ecosystem balance. And it's been a big hit. I think the kids have always impressed me with what they already know. So they're getting some really great education, you know, before we even show up in the classroom about what this is all about.
So do some of them look at that model and go, oh, I want to go to summer camp?
Some of them have, which has been great. Yeah. You know, but you asked the question kind of we talked about in the beginning, like how can you not want to protect this incredible resource? And you ask the kids, like, who here likes to swim or who here likes to fish? And every single hand shoots into the sky and they can't wait to tell you about how they went fishing with, you know, their dad or mom or grandma, grandpa. And just, you know, there's those deep connections are being built at a very young age. And that's why we feel it's important to get into the classrooms and talk about what we're doing. So, you know, it instills in the students at a young age why it's so important to be good stewards in the future.
And hopefully they're not running home and taking their goldfish out and putting them in Lake Pontgorry.
Yeah, we talk about that. This is a model. We say this is a model bull trout or a model kokanee. Yeah. They usually get to pick which one's the bull trout and which one's the kokanee, and they get to name them. And so it's a lot of fun.
It's so important to engage youth in these issues.
Absolutely.
Are there other programs you want to talk about or other directions you're going into with youth engagement or community engagement in general?
We'd love to be able to expand what we offer not only to the youth in our community, but to everybody. As most nonprofits have experienced, though, we're resource limited. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as we're able to increase the amount of money we can raise, we intend to be able to expand those offerings. But the rest of our time is spent addressing some of the priority issues that I went over briefly before, that the wastewater, the stormwater, the coal and oil, pesticides. And so there's no lack of things for us to work on.
Okay. And what about Lunch and Learn? Is that a program you do?
We did have Lunch and Learn going on for a while. Hmm. We have suspended it for now, but would love to bring that back. Yeah.
I know, I'm old. I'm not too old for that one.
No, you're not. Certainly, that's good for all ages.
Never too old for lunch.
Exactly.
Or learning.
Well, I think it's about time for a music break, everyone, and we're going to be hearing an appropriate song. It'll be Jackson Browne with Rock Me on the Water. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to 88.5 FM KRFY, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. If you can't catch all of the program this morning, you can listen to it on a podcast later. And for those of you who have limited reception, you can always go online and live stream it at krfy.org. Take a break and join and continue with more of our interview. Good morning, KFRI listeners. You're listening to 88.5 FM. We're here on the morning show with Phil Huff and myself, Julie Calamine.
Thank you, Julie. It was a wonderful version of Carla Bonhoeff's The Water is Wide. We're back with Shannon from the Lake Pendre Waterkeepers, and we were talking about a lot of the fun programs and interesting programs, the learning for youth and adults and how that just continues to roll on through a lifetime.
Absolutely. It's so important.
So through all of the work you've done, I'm sure you've seen lives change, as some folks say, and have had a number of success stories. Do you want to tell us about a few of them?
Sure. I'd love to. Yeah. So one of our biggest successes was around the herbicide issue, you would say. And so last legislative session, we were able to successfully get a bill passed with the help of Senator Sean Keogh that allows an amendment to the noxious weed law that helps or allows for biological control research to occur. And so what biological control is, the use of naturally occurring predators or pathogens to manage noxious weeds in our waterways. And so before, the law was written in such a way that really research in this area was impossible. And so the toolbox of management techniques was narrow. And so by getting this bill passed, it allows researchers to develop new tools that'll be effective at treating and managing infestations of invasive weeds in our waterways in a natural way, which is really aligned with our mission, and it was a really important thing for us to achieve. And so we were thrilled when we were able to get that passed.
And tell us about what some of those tools are.
So the various tools for management of, I guess, weeds and on land as well as in the water are I guess diverse in the sense that there's many to choose from, but what we advocate for is more narrow. So there's biological control, which I just talked about. There's mechanical control, which is physically removing the weeds from either your yard, or we actually work with the city of Sandpoint to do that in our waterways at City Beach, which is another accomplishment that I'll mention in a second. There's cultural management, which is really prevention and education, which is incredibly important to talk about because these weeds on both land and in water are spread so easily, and it can be very, very preventable by just paying attention to what you're doing as a boater and a recreator. And so education is a really important tool in that toolbox. And then, of course, there's chemical management, which we advocate for reduced use of.
Mm-hmm. So if individuals see weeds, should they just simply pull them, or should they talk to you or contact
somebody? It really depends on the weed. I wouldn't recommend that because we have an increasing problem with flowering rush, which you have to remove very delicately. And if I would suggest or defer to Aaron Mader at the Lakes Commission for information on how to successfully or, you know, carefully remove that plant from your shoreline, because it's not hard to do, but you have to do it in a certain way.
Right.
Yeah.
Phil, and I know a little bit about that. We've helped out at City Beach. And for those homeowners who haven't volunteered, it's a great way to find out what your invasive species are.
Absolutely. And then there's other, you know, management techniques or tools out there, like bottom barriers or benthic barriers that waterfront property owners can put down around their docks that suppress the vegetation and keep their waterways clear for boating and swimming. And so that's a great way to, you know, keep those areas clear without using chemicals.
So we've talked some about weeds and stormwater and wastewater. What are some of the other threats to the lake that the Lake Pend Oreille Waterkeepers are working on?
So another one that we've worked on for several years now is the transport of coal and crude oil through our watershed. And that first came on our radar screen, I guess, back in 2011, shortly after I joined the organization. And really our efforts at that point were focused on coal. There was a big ramp up in the transport of coal from where it was mined in Montana through our area, because some people know this, some others don't, that we're considered the funnel for rail traffic, for everything traveling west to the ports on the West Coast. Everything has to come through Sandpoint. And so that put us at a huge risk, not only to water quality, because this coal is transported in open cars. There's no tarp or cover to them. And also to our overall health and safety. So from an emergency response perspective and an air quality perspective. And so we started working with a very broad coalition of grassroots organizations located throughout Montana, then into our state, and then Oregon and Washington to address this issue. And most of our efforts have focused on really trying to prevent the permitting of export facilities in Washington and Oregon. And we were thrilled to receive the news yesterday that a potential coal export facility, which would have been the largest in the Pacific Northwest, did not receive the necessary permits from the United States Army Corps of Engineers, which is really critical to building this facility, which was incredible. The Army Corps recognized the Lummi Nation's treaty rights to not horribly pollute their sacred fishing grounds and said, no, we're not going to give you these permits. And not only is that a huge win for the Lummi Nation, but for every railside community along the way, because if that facility had been permitted, we were looking at about 112 loaded coal trains per week coming through Sandpoint, and then double that if you consider the empties on top of our current rail traffic, which is about 50 to 60 trains a day. So that would have been a significant increase. And you can imagine what that would do to our quality of life here. So with the coal story, it's been really a big success, I think, for this coalition, which includes the Idaho Conservation League, across multiple states, because we started out facing six proposed coal export terminals, six in Washington and Oregon, some smaller, but a couple very, very large. And collectively, it would have just basically brought Sandpoint to its knees. And now we're down to one. And so that's pretty impressive.
That is quite a success.
I really want to thank the people in the community that have attended hearings on these permitting decisions in Spokane, who have submitted comments to the Army Corps and other permitting agencies. And a lot of people feel like, what can I do? I can't, like, my voice is not going to make a difference. And then this just goes to show that when your voice is added to thousands and thousands and thousands of others, it does make a difference. Mm-hmm. And so there is another opportunity coming up, and I wanted to mention that briefly. Right. Is on Thursday, we're co-sponsoring an event with ICL, Idaho Conservation League, that highlights the Lummi Nation's totem pole journey through the Pacific Northwest. And it's called Our Sacred Obligation. And this is incredibly timely based on when you take into consideration the decision that was made yesterday. It's a really interesting story. And after the film, we're going to be talking about an upcoming opportunity to attend a hearing on the last standing coal export terminal that would be in Longview, Washington, the Millennium Bulk Terminal. And that would also be quite a large one. So we're going to talk about what these hearings look like and what it means and how to craft, powerful comments. And if you're interested in learning how to do that or even learning how to submit written comments, we encourage you all to come out and we'll help you out with that. And the actual hearing date is May 26th in Spokane.
So the event tomorrow night's at the Panada Theater, I believe?
The Little Panada.
It's
on Thursday.
Okay, Thursday. Yeah. Thursday night.
From 7 to 9.
7 to 9. Do folks need tickets for this?
It's a free event.
Free event.
Yes.
So come on down.
Come on down.
Yeah, a great learning opportunity. You mentioned a number of organizations that you've worked with. Are there others?
Yeah. So you know, I mentioned our work with other keepers in our region, but we have to work with, you know, a diverse group of stakeholders. Talked a little bit about the Army Corps. Any agency that's in acts in a permitting capacity, we interact with on some level. That includes the Army Corps, that includes our Idaho State Department of Environmental Quality, that includes the EPA. And so sometimes we interface with them in a commenting capacity where I just mentioned, you know, we create comments that we discuss our concerns around water quality and some of these actions that could happen, like an increase in coal and oil transport through the watershed. And on other times, we share the data that's produced from our water quality monitoring project with our state regulatory agency, as well as recently shared it with the EPA when they were drafting a permit for one of the wastewater treatment facilities here in the region.
So it's a lot of work, all with just two staff, although are you bringing on someone new? Or?
Yes, we are. So our wonderful program director is moving on to a new opportunity, and we have performed a search for an associate director, and we're still in that process, but we're starting to get a better idea of who that person might be. And so we're excited to kind of go in this new direction, and we're still going to be a staff of two, but everyone that is involved with the organization currently and in the past and with our board is incredibly dedicated. So we get a lot done with not a lot of resources.
Wonderful. Although it does take some resources, and we've talked a little bit earlier about some of the organizations funding you. Do you want to speak briefly to how individuals can help in that effort?
Yes, I do. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with the nature of nonprofits in this community. It's one of the beauties of Sandpoint is that there are so many nonprofits and so many opportunities to get involved from a volunteer capacity and also from, you know, a membership or donation capacity. And I can't stress how important that is to the sustainability of our organization. If, you know, without the community support, we just don't exist. We just can't keep our doors open. And so we're super grateful for all the support we get from foundations, but we do have a membership program that you can learn about on our website. It's very affordable, and it really does help us address our issues on a day-to-day basis and perform everything that we've talked about here this morning.
So folks can go to www.lpo.org.
LPOW.org. There's a membership tab. You can look at your different options and see what's a good fit for you. And we often have fundraising events scattered throughout the year that are usually very, very fun. We have events at McDuff's and IPA, and it's just a great time to come out and meet us and get to know us a little bit better and offer your support, which is invaluable.
Well, we're running really short on time here. Any last minute thoughts for us, Shannon?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground, Bill.
Yeah. And a lot of water.
And a lot of water, yeah.
Well, Shannon, I want to thank you for joining us, and we're going to move on to a song break. If those of you are just joining us now, you're listening to 88.5 KRFY, listener-supported radio, community radio for North Idaho. If you aren't able to hear all of the interview today, you can always listen to our podcast later at krfy.org. And if your reception is not perfect, you can always stream us live also at krfy.org. We'll move on to a song, and I promise this time it is Jackson Browne with Rock Me on the Water. You're joining Julie and Phil on the Tuesday Morning Show, and we're going to come back with some community events. And Phil, why don't you tell us about some of those?
Sure. Well, we've got a pretty busy week, and I'm not quite sure how much time we have to go through all of the things, but it's Unplug and Be Outside this week. So step away from TVs, computers, tablets, phones, and other devices. Join Sandpoint, Parks and Recreation, plus many local clubs and organizations for Unplug and Be Outside. That's over the next couple days. Tonight we have the Ales for Trails at the Idaho Poor Authority, sponsored by the Idaho Poor Authority, to benefit the Watershed Crest Trail being developed by the Pondre Peddlers Bike Club. Tomorrow we have, tomorrow is the 11th, Magic Wednesday at Jalapeno's Restaurant. On the 12th, we have happy hour at McDuff's Beer Hall for the Chafe 150. That's from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And we have the screening of Totem Pole, the film that Shannon mentioned earlier, sponsored by the Idaho Conservation League, Our Sacred Obligation, at 7 p.m. at the Little Panda Theater, 300 North 1st Avenue. The film depicts the 22-day-long journey by members of the Lumni Nation made along the proposed Northwest Coal Train Path. The journeyers brought along traditional hand-carved totem pole, a symbol of their support for the First Nations' opposition to the expansion of crude oil and coal. Discussion after the screening will include an update on the upcoming May 26th hearing in Spokane for the proposed Millennium Coal Terminal in Longview, Washington.
And some of the upcoming morning show information. Tomorrow, Wednesday the 11th, join Chris Bessler and Jim Healy on the Wednesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show and the Election 2016 series. The guests will be Bonner County Sheriff candidates Daryl Wheeler and Terry G. Ford. That's tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock on 88.5. And then on Thursday, that's the 12th, tune into the morning show at 8 with Jack Peterson and Jim Healy, and their guest will be Dino Wall, who is the executive director of the festival at Sandpoint. She'll be in to talk about this year's festival lineup. That's on 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for the North. Phil, maybe you could take us out with a quick quote. No, let's not. We'll just take us out with a song. It's been a great show, everyone.
Thank you, Julie.
All right. Have a great week, everyone.